Riverhead Books presents Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, a podcast with Marlon James and Jake Morrissey.
There is something very rich in tearing a book apart.
I don't want to spend my eyeballs on these 300 pages.
You really don't have to read any novel, except maybe Moby Dick.
I'm stunned hearing you say that.
The first book I got was Journal of a Plague Year.
The feel-good book of the pandemic, ladies and gentlemen.
I know. I'm a reverse size queen when it comes to literature, I guess.
Okay, I love this more and more.
This would be the part where I go, I am Marlon James. So I guess that makes you Jake Morrissey.
I'm Jake Morrissey, and we're here to talk about the dead authors we read over the pandemic. But first of all, I want to talk to you, Marlon James, to find out, how was your pandemic?
You know what? For everybody, welcome back. I don't think I've ever been in something that had a second season. Actually, I don't think I've been in anything that had a first season. Come to think of it. But yeah, so, you know, we're back. I'm telling you, we're back like nail fungus. God, the pandemic. What can I say about the pandemic? I'm fatter.
I find that very hard to believe.
You know what? I mean, I tried, I think. Because most of the pandemic, I was actually in Connecticut. I was in New York, and I was in Minnesota, and I spent a lot of time writing. I gave a commencement speech, which was interesting because it was a video, and I was telling everybody, "No, I am not in the movie Get Out."
Was it live? So, or did you tape it first?
It was taped.
Okay.
And funny enough, I didn't read as many books as I thought I would. I read quite a few, but a lot of time I just spent cursing imaginary people, all sorts of expletives, because I'm in a pandemic.
Well, what I wanted to know is, actually, when we're thinking about this, is did you find that you relied on certain authors or books to get you through the pandemic or the stress or the uncertainty or whatever?
I know I tried.
Oh.
You know, I had big ambitions. The first book I got was Journal of a Plague Year.
The feel-good book of the pandemic, ladies and gentlemen.
I know. I'm like, I'm gonna figure this out. Or I'm gonna, you know, I journal quite a bit. I'm like, let's get Journal of a Plague Year and do a plague journal. And I think in less than 7 days, it would be a year since I went to Connecticut because of this pandemic. And I think out of the entire year for a diary, I think I wrote in it maybe four times. Out of what, 365
right.
days?
Right. So the spirit was strong, the musculature less so.
I think everything was pretty weak, come think of it. I thought this would be my sort of Journal of a Plague Year, my mask fifth or sixth novel that started out as a diary or something, and it didn't. Also, I actually didn't actually read the damn book either.
Well, what did you read?
I was like, you know, I read, I read, and I wrote it down somewhere in case I forgot, which is no comment on the book. I reread Beloved.
Okay, excellent.
By Toni Morrison. Excellent. And because, you know, I'm writing the sequel to Black Leopard, Red Wolf. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away about the book, but it made me go back to a lot of these books that I consider foundational novels, and a lot of them are written by Toni Morrison. So Beloved and Song of Solomon, what is that? Go back to 100 Years of Solitude. You know, the minor classics.
Now, did you notice different things about them? Did different things strike you? Or did you find that you were kind of validated by your perceptions of them initially?
I found them, in a weird way, simpler, and not in a bad way. Mm-hmm. That particularly Beloved, that Morrison doesn't use a lot of theatrics to get her point across. And there are times in that novel I was like, damn, this is almost deceptively simple.
Interesting.
And One thing I always loved about Morrison is that she allows her characters to do things I don't think other people allow their characters to do. And sometimes unseemly things. Sometimes it's just something tossed off. you know, sometimes it's private things, sometimes it's dirty things, sometimes it's filthy things, sometimes it's highly questionable stuff. And I love the sort of attention she pays to that sort of stuff. And I can always tell when I'm reading Toni Morrison, because then my books usually get twice as long.
That is such an encouraging thing for an editor to hear. You have no idea. But that's interesting to hear that you went back to kind of the foundational texts as a as a writer and also as a reader. And because my experience in the pandemic was I wanted to go back to books and stories that I had and writers that I knew about or knew of or had read before. And also I found that I yearned for a certain structure. And that led me to like Sherlock Holmes stories. Not deathless literature by any means, but they were like, all right, here's the scenario, here's the world, here's Holmes and Watson, here's the problem, here's the very logical way that they kind of solved it and got out of the problem, which was sort of the thing that I think I found myself in the pandemic wondering about. It's like, how do I get my head around this fact that it's so open-ended and so kind of uncertain. And another author I kind of went back to a lot was Octavia E. Butler. I mean, I reread Kindred, which I thought was, I had read when my daughters were younger and thought it was this kind of, you know, they had read it in school and I had kind of read it as well. It's, to your point about it being simpler, it's very, the way she kind of tells the story, it's deceptively simple, I think. In other words, I found a lot more nuance in it than I saw before. And I think that was a useful, interesting.
The thing I find interesting about Octavia Butler, as I don't think anybody through no choice of theirs has gone from speculative fiction to historical fiction. Meaning that there's so many things in Octavia Butler's novels that have now come true, including the phrase "Make America Great Again," that now they read like historical novels.
Right, right. Well, and the whole thing about, you know, when I was reading Kindred, it was like that this sort of scenario, the scenarios that the characters dealt with and the, you know, issues of race and relationships, people, you know, people of different races being in, it was sort of presented as something that was, you know, this is the way the story is unfolding. And in a way that that seems to be sort of truer and truer nowadays than it was certainly than when I was a kid. So it was a great realization, as you said, is that some of the stuff was almost prescient. And Make America Great or whatever it was a little like, oh, I didn't realize it came from Octavia Butler.
Well, I don't think Trump got it from Octavia Butler, because that would be implying that Trump reads.
Exactly.
And I'm pretty sure the only thing Trump reads is things like flush after use. Let me not, you know, who knows, maybe I just pissed off 70% of our...
Well, you know what, the truth shall set us free is all that I can say. But I do think the idea that, you know, some of these like stories that I went back to is that I read as a kid, and most of them were not, you know, literary, most of them were not, you know, but they were, you know, I stumbled across Louise Fitzhugh again, you know, Harriet the Spy. Here's a girl who goes around Manhattan and essentially spies on people and writes down in her journal. You're talking about journaling. You kind of, you know, I had a different reaction to it now as a, you know, a middle-aged father of two. It's like, wait a minute, this is your, you know, she did this living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, Harriet the Stalker kind of thing. And you realize...
I was going to go, it sounds like Mama's Little Pervert.
Kind of. And, you know, what she kind of, you know, discovers is nothing, you know, in that vein. It's much more about observing neighbors and people and the relationships that that Harriet has with her family and her governess and all this sort of. But in other words, you come to these stories again, to your point about somebody like Toni Morrison with Beloved or whatever, you come to these stories again a different person than you were when you read it the first time. And that affected the way I read the books. And it's not that it wasn't, I still enjoyed it, but I wondered, it's a little bit like watching movies again that you had seen that you thought, oh, you know, I remember seeing like a John Hughes movie and then seeing it again like 5 or 6 years ago, things, wait, this is pretty creepy for reasons that have nothing to do with the fact, nothing to do with my ideas back when I saw it the first time back in the 80s.
Yeah, it's and sometimes you realize, and I'm trying to think of a book No, and all I can think of is maybe some maybe a Mailer novel that I can't bring to my, I can't single out, or one or an Up That novel I can't single out. When you realize, you know what, they were kind of creepy then too. We kind of just sort of we allowed for it. You know what, I one thing, one book I read during, you know, let's call it a pandemic book, that I had never read before, and it's one of the secret shames. It's you know, it could be, you know, if we ever start this column about books we should have read but we haven't. But I want to talk about it here, because when you said being a different person, it's funny. This is the first time I've read it, but I knew had I read it before, I would have read it differently. Yep. And it's Giovanni's Room.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
By Baldwin. I read that actually just I mean probably like a few months ago, mm-hmm. if not a month ago, and felt so seen.
Oh wow. And okay.
And now with hindsight and with getting older and with coming out and with all of that, I can look at it from a historical perspective. Yes. But if I had read this when I was 23, I would never have finished it.
Oh wow.
Because I'd have felt called out. There's so many things about it. Some of it is not even the gay stuff that hit me. It's like the narrator resenting his father trying to be his friend instead of his dad.
Yep.
I was like, shit. I know that part. I know the whole kind of, you sort of had this kind of internal death. That's not suicide. It's way longer and it's way more subtle. Yeah. And it's... yeah, a friend of mine said to me, it's a homophobic book. And I thought about that. I thought, you know, but a lot of gay men, is particularly, even now when they write a book, there is some thread of self-hatred that goes through there, because that's what we learn.
Well, actually, that raises an interesting point. Will there be a point in the evolution of gay men growing up and reading books like Giovanni's Room and things like that who will not feel the self-hatred?
Yeah, because I didn't, I mean, I'm not saying I felt it, I didn't feel it reading it now. Mm-hmm. I'd have definitely felt it reading it then, and I still would have envied it, mm-hmm. because the main character at least did something, you know, or at least gave in, and I've thought of terms like gave in,
yeah.
Once and twice, and it cost them, but no, I think... I would have been too afraid to finish it, because I think it would be saying something about me. Mm-hmm. And even reading it now, I was like, damn, that, yep, did that. Yep, I know that. It reminded me the time when, I'm still pretty sure I misread Steppenwolf. But I remember getting to some point, and I think it had this, to me, it seemed like an irrefutable argument for suicide. I was like, I can't.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, not next. Right, not next.
Not right now. Yeah. Wow, this conversation got super dark.
Well, I didn't mean it to, because what I was talking. I mean, I ended up also reading a bunch of plays, and mm-hmm. the plays that, and I think I've talked about this before, that I thought were well structured, that tended to be more funny, that took me out of kind of where mm-hmm. I was, and at the same time, I reread Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And the reason mm-hmm. I read it is that I came across a comment that Edward Albee made. I think it was Edward Albee made about that. There's a joke in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf every 20 seconds, or laugh every 20 seconds. In my humble mm-hmm. opinion, there is not a laugh in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf every 20 seconds. However, there are parts of it that are very funny. And what I was interested in seeing is, because I have seen, mm-hmm. you know, there's the famous movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. There are endless productions of it in New York and elsewhere. And it's always about, depending on the production, it's always about a different character. Because the movie's about Elizabeth Taylor. And mm-hmm. the most recent production I saw of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it was about George, the character. George and Martha are married. Anyway, my point in all this is that by seeing something, and maybe this is a less esoteric, a less kind of smart way of saying what you were saying, is that by rereading something that I've already read, it allows me to think about kind of both my reaction to it and the structure of it, and sort of seeing in it, seeing the if you will, the sort of scaffolding, or seeing how, you know, things were, you know, decorated, or the decoration was taken down, or being able to sort of see through the decoration to find out that it's actually what it's made of, that I found an interesting kind of intellectual and also kind of emotional experience that I probably wouldn't have done if there hadn't been, you know, lockdowns everywhere and tens of thousands of people dying every day.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's funny. I heard of the play Who's Afraid of, or really saw the movie Who's Afraid of Virginia mm-hmm. Woolf before I knew who Virginia Woolf was. So I always thought Virginia Woolf was like the real estate agent,
right,
or the bill collector, or is Virginia Woolf with the IRS,
the nice, like, lady down the block. Why, yeah, that's true.
Why are you afraid of her? She's a nice name, like Virginia.
Well, speaking of Virginia Woolf, I, you know, one of the things I also spent too much time doing was, like, you know, trolling YouTube. And one of the things I came across, I know exactly, it's come to this.
Wow.
Anyway, my point is that the Fendi summer fashion show,
those are not the four words I expect to come out of your mouth.
But the before the show starts, and the reason it was in the news was it was Demi Moore made a surprise. She was the sort of first model down the runway, apparently. But my point is, at the beginning of the show, because it was done during lockdown and there were no audiences or whatever, before they started, there was this particular music, and then there was a, like, 2-minute recording of the only known recording of Virginia Woolf, who writes, mm-hmm. who talks about words and the power of words, and how, right, and how old words, it's, and how hard it is to write, because it's the combinations of words that you are drawn to have been used before by better writers, basically. She talks about, you know, a particular quote mm-hmm. from Macbeth or whatever. Anyway, I thought, wait a minute, I go from Edward Albee to hearing Virginia Woolf to a fashion show mm-hmm. back to Sherlock Holmes. Okay, somebody needs to sedate me and put me out of my misery, clearly.
Or put this whole plague behind us. I mean, God, you read a lot of books. I mean, a lot of books I read during the pandemic is because I was going to interview the author.
Well, I did not have that.
So they're all living.
And I also did not have, nobody wanted to talk to me. And also, you're trying to write a book, right?
I guess. I mean, that's the plan.
That's the rumor, is that he's going to be writing another book.
It's the rumor, you know? And usually, usually the bulk of the books, of course, I read when I'm writing. I mean, I usually have like a sort of writer's library when I'm writing a book, which is why there is Beloved and a bunch of novels like that. But yeah, I wish I could say that this pandemic made me read faster. You know, I think it, I don't think it did. I think I spend way too much time going, fucking hell, this pandemic. That actually say, you know, let's be constructive about it.
Well, you said something interesting earlier that I think is worth, I'm interested in hearing what you say about it. Because are there authors or books that you sort of realized you should have read in your life by now that you haven't?
Oh my God.
I mean, we can call it, you know, even a pandemic can't make me read more of, you know, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know. I really do think it's not that I'm trying to stay away from them with a 10-foot pole. I really think I want to get to them at some point. I haven't read Forster.
Okay.
I haven't read Room with a View or A Passage to India or Maurice.
Okay, I would.
I own
okay,
all of
now,
them.
Of those three, of Room with a View, A Passage to India, and Maurice, or Morris, I guess, which one would you read first?
Probably Room with a View. Passage to India, I don't know if I can deal with Orientalism. Yes. If it has it, I don't know. Maurice, everybody tells me, is an absolutely terrible novel that he didn't want published. Room with a View, at least I remember all the men were naked in the movie.
read a Room with a View, because all the men were naked in the movie is not the back cover copy I want to write.
No, Beerman, I haven't actually... The worst part is I haven't actually seen the movie. I've just like Googled rumored of you and their men frolicking around naked. I'm like, okay, this looks like it could be a good book, even though it's a movie.
A Room with a View is of the Forster novels, I read the lightest one because it's essentially a comedy of manners married to kind of an Edwardian romance. And it is about unleashing passion. And yes, there are, you know, naked people running through the sort of sylvan glens of in the movie. But it's also, I think, a story about what are you willing to do to kind of, you know, embrace the love that is, you know, in front of you, embrace life and all that sort of thing. A Passage to India, I found tough because I'm not a huge fan of let's reexamine British imperialism as it relates to India.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that either. It's coming from a former British colony.
Exactly.
Nah, I ain't got time for that.
And, you know, I remember meeting Morris a long time ago and thinking, yeah, this is not very good. And I mean, in terms of the novel itself, I mean, anyway, Forster is somebody that I've read enough of. Thank you very much. It's like I'm ready to move on. you know, if I never read another page of Thomas Hardy, that's okay by me.
I think I need to go back to Jude the Obscure. I never finished that novel. It was too intense. I'm like, God, is this? Why do I feel it's all downhill from here? And I'm already wanting to slit my own wrist.
Basically, it's with Hardy. It's always downhill. There's never any like, you know.
That explains why I got it was one of those books I only read half of, but I took the English exam. And I was gambling that, you know what? I think I know how this is going to turn out. I think I can write this paper.
I think you can, yes.
And I didn't fail.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you what grade I got, but I didn't fail. Who else was I thinking of I haven't read yet? I haven't read Doris Lessing. And I have tons. I can scan over. I have like tons of her books. And I keep going, this is somebody I have to read and I haven't read yet.
Okay, for me, Doris Lessing is the... she's kind of the milk of magnesia of Nobel Prize winning novelists. I mean, I know she's good for me, but I don't like it when I read it. I mean, The Golden Notebook, I think the literary term is unendurable, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, everybody else loved it. I'm like, this is 180 pages too long.
You're such an editor. Like you say stuff like that.
I know. That's the realization is that I couldn't get away from that.
How did I get 670 pages past?
Because you can actually, you're actually an interesting writer. I understand why people like her. I understand why she's appreciated and lionized. But I just was not there. There was a moment where somebody mentioned Flannery O'Connor, and I would have to be reborn to go back and read Flannery O'Connor. Says the well-brought-up Catholic boy. I never bought into her.
Yeah, I read a few of her stories. I actually read quite a few of them, and I teach some of them. I've never been tempted to read Wise Blood.
I did.
I've been tempted to steal the title Wise Blood. But yeah, and you know, it's not that I'm staying away from reading shitty people. I mean, Knut Hamsun is still around here somewhere.
Well, the point, my problem with her is that her overt or subliminal racism notwithstanding, I just don't think I never found her funny. I never found her quirky enough to be interesting. She was one of those. I mean, at the risk of sounding obnoxious, I grew up around these. Judgmental Catholic ladies from the 20th century. And I'm like, you know what? Take your purse and your gloves and go someplace else.
This is something that could probably take up a whole episode, so I don't want to dwell too much on it. The whole, what do you do when you know, the author is a shitty person?
Yeah.
And one of the things that happen is people contorting themselves into all sorts of shapes to explain her. It's like, near the end of her life, there was a turnaround. I'm like, fine, but I'm not sure Baldwin would care.
Exactly.
You know, saying that, you know, the whole thing, don't find him interesting and he's the worst of the lot or whatever. I couldn't remember what she said. And does that affect, I mean, if I'm going to start not reading authors because of their stance. I'm not going to live with a lot of authors. And that was my nice way of saying I'm not going to live with a lot of old white people.
Right, right, absolutely.
You know, I'd have to put away my Dickens and put away Mailer and put away... I mean, it's easier for me to put away Mailer than to put away Dickens.
Yes.
So, yes. And I think that's something that we can talk about a much longer, episode. But I also think that a racist author or a sexist author or a homophobic author, that lack of empathy sometimes translates into their work. And I think a lot of times they're given a sort of a free pass, because I don't think the people reading those works realize they also don't have the empathy. Like Heart of Darkness. Mm-hmm. Maybe the reason why a certain person can't see the problem with Heart of Darkness is that you also have the problem.
Yep. Yep.
And fine, that's nothing wrong. I mean, there is a ton of things wrong with that, but it's at least a starting point.
I want to sort of wind up this episode by asking you, Marlon, the three questions that I asked you a year ago on the last episode we recorded before the pandemic sort of descended, and I didn't ask,
changed everything.
Yeah, suddenly you're writing movie trailers here, but I didn't want an answer from you then, but now I want the answer. And the three questions are, the first one was, what book by a dead author do you wish you had written?
Funny enough, I mean, God, there are thousands of those, but let me just pick one. Lord of the Flies.
Oh, the whole thing? I mean, like, oh, no, never mind.
I'm
thinking Lord of the Rings. Sorry, Lord of the Flies. Okay. All right.
the whole thing. I said, damn, that's harsh.
No.
It's not even 200, it's not even 300 pages.
The Lord of the Flies. Why do you wish you had written The Lord of the Flies?
One of the things I think I am interested in that William Golding is also interested in is the fall of quote unquote man. The fall of society, blah blah blah. But I also think if I had written that book, I'd written it in very, you know, quite differently. I think, you know, if I'd written it, I think they'd have gone so-called barbaric way quicker. I actually think that I would tie it that you know, repressive civilization and. The thing about Lord of the Rings is that these guys didn't. We like to think that they went back to themselves and their nature. They went barbaric, and that's not it at all. All the things, all the aspects, the terrible aspects of their behavior, they already have and were already showing. I always say the most inevitable consequence of Victorian society was Jack the Ripper. It's the only aspect of Victorian society that was not a surprise. Of course he happened. How could he not have happened? And I think that the savagery to me would have happened, you know, before. You know, I think before I even wrote my second novel, one of the ideas I've been beating around my head for years, and it's only in thinking about this podcast that I remember that I was really committed to it. I really wanted to write a sequel to Lord of the Flies.
Now, would it have been... All right, one of the things about Lord of the Flies that struck me, there were white kids who were in a British private school?
Right.
So, in other words, they were all coming from the same pod, if you will. So, does that matter to the larger sort of story? Or, in other words,
I think it matters, but I think... Sorry, you're...
No, I'm just going to say, I mean, in your sequel, would you have... Mm-hmm. I mean, would there still be... a bunch of rich, privileged boys?
They'd be rich, privileged men now.
I see. You're using the same characters.
Oh, the same characters. Not Lord of the Flies to Electric Boogaloo. You know, Lord of the Flies, back to the rock. You know, Lord of the Flies, we cooking now. No. I actually wanted to explore where do the adults, it's sort of adults... who committed an atrocity as children, right. Where did they go? Particularly within that society. So I was very much interested in, and I think about it all the time. It's one of those novels, and there are very few novels for me that do it, where I become obsessed with pre and post the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I said they were savages before they hit that island is that, you know, this is the type of culture through which hazing came about.
Totally.
I think, totally. But I also think Golding kind of knows that, which is why Golding to me always struck me as a very pessimistic author. That's why I wrote an intro for Pinchot Martin last year. And that's one of the things I talk about, you know, and I tried very hard not to mention Lord of the Flies. But that it's I think he realizes that everything that these boys needed to become who they were on the island, they took there.
Mm-hmm.
The island didn't give them anything.
Right.
They didn't show up and like, I'm wild, I'm free and homicidal. No, they brought that shit there.
Interesting.
And I think, I wish I'd... That's for this week, the one I wish I had written.
Right. All right. Well, that's actually fascinating because my second question was, what book by a dead author would you change the outcome of?
No, this one is kind of burning me because the author did try to change the outcome, but she did. She died before. To Kill a Mockingbird, Ghost at a Watchman.
So you're saying that she wanted to change To Kill a Mockingbird into Ghost at a Watchman, or was...
No, well, Ghost at a Watchman was before To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay, yes, okay.
What the reason why I brought up these two is I've said this before and I'll say it again. Ghost at a Watchman is the absolute... It's the worst novel, but it's the better Atticus.
Because?
Because I never bought for a second that Atticus in the South is of such outstanding character with no ambiguity, with no threat of bigotry himself.
Okay.
There's a certain kind of American liberal imagination that needs to believe that. That's why there are so many boys named Atticus.
So the idea that he was somewhere, and I can't remember if I read it in the novel or maybe saw it, the movie version, but isn't there a point where Atticus says something like, you know, essentially this guy deserves, you know, decent representation or a fair trial or whatever. And what you're saying is that there was a much bigger sort of head put on top of that idea that this somehow Atticus was the kind of pure man in terms of supporting, you know, the downtrodden.
Yeah, but it's set fire to the liberal imagination in a way that boomers in particular. That's why so many. A lot of Gen X kids named Atticus.
Right. Right.
But I think it's a false idea, and I think ultimately it didn't serve us well.
Mm-hmm.
I think somebody who is bigoted trying to do the right thing and maybe they evolve would have done a lot more good. I don't think it's a... First, let me make it clear. I don't think it's novels' jobs to do good for the world.
Right.
But I think that that is a complication, particularly about a book from the South that we could have really used.
Okay.
And I think I would have changed To Kill a Mockingbird to be a little bit closer to Ghost at a Watchman.
In terms of how the character is?
Yeah, in terms of what the character is and what that type of personality leads to. Because character, of course, leads to plot, not the other way around, at least for me.
Oh, good. That's interesting. Character leads to plot. Okay.
I always start with... Well, when I write, I always start with character and go, what the hell are you going to get me to know? And it's a doozy with this book I'm writing now. Not that I'm promoting myself.
Not at all. Well, when you mention sort of your writing process, I mean, what skill does a dead author have that you wish you had?
So we've been talking at the beginning of this podcast about simplicity, and there is still a kind of British colonial indoctrinated part of me who still believes a 10-letter word is better than a 5-letter word.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember talking to... It may have been... You know what? I can't tell which of the two it was, so let's not name either.
Okay.
Let's call them two Booker Prize winning authors. And we all at one point sat down and talked about how we struggle with English language, even though that's what we speak, because we were taught colonial English. And it took me a while to realize that when most of the times that I'm speaking standard English, at least until the Americans poisoned my vocabulary, that I sounded like the butler. And to the point where I was in a country which I shall not name because they sued me the last time I said anything bad about them, where I knew that the people were so verbose that the type of person who is harassing me for an autograph will take so long to get to the point that I could walk away before he even gets halfway. And I'm not saying that as a diss because I am just as bad. And I have a feeling that's one of the reasons why most of my novels are in first person, because I'm scared of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's my long-winded way of saying when I went back and read 100 Years of Solitude, the simplicity floored me, and I'm still trying to figure out how to do it. Certainly in third person. I don't know if I'm there. I think I'm getting there with first person. I still don't know how to do it.
Do you think it's better? In terms of the sort of simplicity, is it? What I'm really wondering is it? Does it have to do with the clarity of what you want to say?
Yeah. Some of that is that, and I think I write towards figuring out what I want to say, and my characters do that too. Mm-hmm. Where they kind of fumble towards meaning instead of knowing what they want. But even that, you could say there, you know, there isn't a lot of existential doubt in a Marquez character, mm-hmm. you know, but there's a lot in what's his name? Why am I blanking? He wrote The Outsider. There's a lot in a Camus character, and it's still simple. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's trusting words. And I think I don't know if I still write sometimes like somebody who doesn't trust words.
The more the better? Is that what you're saying? I mean, because you're not trusting
words? I don't trust simple words. There's still part of me that still believes the big muscular horse ran quickly is a stronger sentence than the stallion galloped. Which is, of course, bullshit. It is nowhere near as strong as the stallion galloped. But there's a part of me that goes,
really interesting.
But I was raised to write the big muscular horse ran quickly. I was raised that way.
So you're fighting against your education.
Absolutely. With every sentence. I'm fighting against thinking adverbs are your friends. Adverbs are not your friends. But that, simplicity or trusting simplicity, I should say, is a skill. Not even the simplicity, the trusting it. That's not what I wish I had. And I think Morrison had it. I think Marquez had it.
And Marlon is reaching toward it, is what you're saying.
You know what? You got to have ambition, Jake.
Well, as usual, you've given me a lot to talk about. That's all we've got for this episode.
Wait, we have
so
2
thank
minutes.
You for listening.
Where are you going?
Oh, wait, are you? Oh, no, you were going to tell
me
something
else. Are you trying to get rid of me, Jake?
No, not at all.
Podcast audience, the first episode, and he's already trying to get rid of me. But anyway, so I think it's something where we talked about that if we're going to read authors no longer with us, that it shouldn't mm-hmm. just be stuff that we've read long ago and bring to discussion. I think we should actually read some books and talk about them real time. And the book, I want to recommend a book that we read maybe in time for the next podcast or the one after. Have you read William Attaway's Blood on the Forge?
No.
There are people who call it The Black Grapes of Wrath. And it's a novel about the sort of Dust Bowl depression, poor family trying to make it. But it's a black family who part of the Great Migration. And Blood on the Forge came out. It didn't get a lot of attention because, well, Grapes of Wrath got it. And William Attaway actually wrote one novel before this. He wrote this novel. And then he quit writing fiction and went into writing music. So if you are reading, for example, the sheet, the music sheet for Deo, he probably wrote it, even if he didn't really write the song.
Wow.
So, and the book got reissued a few years ago, and I've always been curious to read it. And I think it'd be cool to go back and read, because the Dust Bowl kind of novel is such a white kind of novel, and it's such a huge part of the 20th century canonical novel. You have the Jazz Age, and then you have the Depression Age. And when we think of the Depression Age novel, we think of Grapes of Wrath and novels like that. So I think that would be really a really interesting novel to check out. So I think we should read it.
That's a good idea. I'm looking forward to doing that. Absolutely.
And now you can end the show.
Thank you. So that's all we have for you for this episode. So thank you for listening. We do want to hear from you, so send us your feedback and ideas at wereaddeadpeople@penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you enjoy this episode, we hope you'll subscribe to us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to rate this podcast, as it helps more people to discover Marlon's brilliance and my apparently unfortunate habit of being wrong about everything.
You can follow Riverhead Books on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for updates on all things books, all of them written by living authors, of course. And we'll have links in the show notes to the books that we've read today.
So that's it.
Thanks for listening, and go read some dead people. They're as dead as the last time we spoke.
Listening to Marlon and Jake means my to-read list gets longer every week. Enter Libro.fm. Libro.fm lets me purchase audiobooks directly from my favorite local bookstore. I can pick from more than 185,000 titles, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. I get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But I'm part of a different story, one that supports community. And you can be too. Marlon and Jake Read Dead People listeners can get a special offer. 2 audiobooks for the price of 1 with your first month of membership. That's 2 audiobooks for just $14.99 with the code Marlon and Jake. Visit Libro.fm to get started. Now go read some dead people. Offer only valid for new members in Canada and the US.